Ever think about the meaning of life? The nature of existence? What constitutes the ideal state? What is virtue? Then you would certainly have been at home among the Greeks. The Greeks delighted in analyzing the world, whereas by and large the Romans got on with running it. And in this regard, the two peoples could hardly have been more different. Just think of the great names in Greek philosophy: Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And in the second league, there's Epicurus, Zeno, and Diogenes. Hardly the second league, really, each of them being the founders of philosophical movements that were immensely important in antiquity: the Epicurean, Stoic, and Cynic, respectively. And as for the Romans, well, they didn't really produce a single philosopher of world-class stature. Even so, there were a number of them who did make a significant contribution to the discipline and who did attempt to live their lives in accordance with strict philosophical principles, including Cicero, Seneca, and Marcus Aurelius. As we saw in the previous lecture, philosophical inquiry, along with rhetoric, was one of the two main topics of study for the Roman elite, from the 2nd century BC to the 2nd century AD, a period of almost 400 years. What interested the Romans primarily, however, was the study of ethics. Questions such as what is the summum bonum, the highest good, which certainly preoccupied Cicero. They weren't much interested in either natural philosophy or abstract speculation. By and large, they didn't engage in arguments about the nature of matter. And I can't imagine many of them sitting around and saying, what do you make of all this business of being a non-being? As Lenny says to Teddy in Harold Pinter's play, The Homecoming. There are a couple of points I'd like to note from the start that gave philosophy its specific identity in antiquity. First, it was an inherently elitist occupation. Only the well-heeled had the leisure and resources to indulge in it, and that was as true of Rome as it was of Greece. And at least some philosophers commanded very large fees for their services, consonant with the size of their reputations, though this would not have been true of all. The arrival of a leading philosopher created quite a stir, whether we're talking of Rome or Athens or anywhere else. There's evidence of the importance of top-flight philosophers in antiquity, in the fact that likenesses of them, in the form of statues and coins, were produced throughout the ancient world. We have portraits of all the philosophical superstars, including Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Chrysippus, Epicurus, and Diogenes. The second point is that ethics was tailored to a limited set of questions. Ethics was not concerned with the welfare of the human race in general, but with the welfare of the philosopher himself. We're talking chiefly about men, though we do hear of a few women philosophers, the most notable of whom was the mathematician named Hypatia of Alexandria. So the focus of philosophical debate was the consequences of an ethical or unethical action for the doer, rather than its consequences for those who are affected by the deed. According to tradition, the father of philosophical inquiry was Thales of Miletus, 625 to 547, whom we discussed in our lecture on science and technology. And there we established that there was no clear division between philosophy and science. Aristotle credits Thales with being the first thinker to investigate the material cause of existence, which he declared to be water. Natural philosophy, philosophy which asked the question, what is the world made of, remained the dominant concern of thinkers in the Greek world until the middle decades of the 5th century BC. Parmenides, who was born around 515 and came from Elea, a Greek colony in Campania, taught that being is eternal, indivisible, and unchanging. Conversely, Heraclitus, his near contemporary who came from Ephesus, held that all things are in a perpetual state of flux. Around 450, however, a new philosophical trend emerged. one that was focused on human beings. Its practitioners were known as sophists, a word which means literally sage or expert. Sophists were professional teachers who claimed to be able to impart wisdom, sophia, to their students. One of the greatest of them was Protagoras of Abdera, 490 to 420, who visited Athens several times and was a friend of the statesman Pericles. Protagoras declared magisterially, "Man is the measure of all things, of the being of things that are, and the non-being of things that are not." Wow. The fact that Pericles himself questioned received belief may have contributed to Athens's popularity as a destination for the sophists. Because of Plato's hostility to the sophistic movement, and because the writings of the sophists have largely been lost, however, it is almost impossible to make a balanced estimate of their contribution to philosophy. Their most bitter foe was Socrates, who objected firstly to the fact that sophists charged for their services. And another reason why Socrates found them so offensive was because they taught philosophical relativism. Man is the measure. There are no absolutes. Whereas he was the originator of idealist philosophy, the branch of philosophical inquiry which seeks to establish the absolute, unchanging value of concepts such as piety and justice and truth. Socrates never wrote anything. But he did initiate a philosophical method of inquiry, which to this day is the basis for continuing speculative thought. His method, quite simply, was to set forth a proposition, or more often to ask his interlocutors to set forth a proposition, and then subject it to rigorous questioning. Socrates' pupil, Plato, 429 to 347, used his master as the principal speaker in almost all his dialogues. And it is largely through his writings that Socrates has had such an important influence on Western philosophy. As a result, it's virtually impossible to distinguish the teachings of Socrates from those of Plato. Plato's pupil was Aristotle, 384 to 322, the one-time tutor of Alexander the Great, whose works cover every branch of philosophical inquiry and science that was current in his day. Together, Plato and Plato's great pupil Aristotle mapped out the terrain for all philosophical inquiry that took place subsequently in the ancient world. Plato, the great idealist, Aristotle, the great synthesizer. Athens was the philosophical center of the Mediterranean, virtually throughout antiquity. Athens hosted the sophists. Athens was the home of Socrates and Plato. Both Plato's Academy and Aristotle's Lyceum were established in Athens, and Athens remained a leading center of philosophy into the Hellenistic and Roman imperial periods. It was also the birthplace of two other highly influential schools, both of which were founded in the early Hellenistic period, a generation or so after the death of Alexander the Great, and which began to make an impact on the Romans in the 2nd century BC. The first was Epicureanism, named after Epicurus, an Athenian who flourished around 300 BC. The Epicureans lived in seclusion in a complex called the Garden and maintained a simple style of living. They included women and slaves among their adherents. The second was Stoicism, whose adherents, the Stoics, or men of the Stoa, took their name from the Stoa Poikile, or Painted Stoa, a colonnaded building in the northwest corner of the Agora in Athens. The building actually came to light in 1981. It was called the Painted Stoa because of its spectacular wall paintings, paintings done on wooden panels which were displayed in the Stoa. And it was here, in the early 3rd century BC, that a Phoenician merchant from Kytium in Cyprus named Zeno gave instruction to his followers, who were known first as Zenonians and later as Stoics. The Romans had no tradition of philosophical speculation until they encountered the Greeks. As a practical people, they were inherently suspicious of Greek philosophy at first. And we've seen how in 173 BC and again in 161, the Senate expelled philosophers from Rome. We don't know exactly why they were so suspicious. Did they object to the fact that the philosophers were teaching their pupils to question traditional Roman values? Or did they see them in a more sinister light than that, encouraging perhaps the questioning of Rome's entitlement to rule? Whatever the answer, in 155 BC, they permitted the heads of the three major philosophical schools in Athens to visit Rome. Diogenes, head of the Stoic school, Critolaus, head of the Lyceum, and Carneades, head of the Academy. It was one of those moments when a sea change came over Roman attitudes through contact with Hellenism. Plutarch tells us that the charm of Carneades was such that it won large and sympathetic audiences. The news spread far and wide that a Greek of outstanding talent had infused a powerful passion into the young men, so that renouncing other pleasures and activities, they were ecstatic about philosophy. Wow, renouncing other pleasures? That seems a bit of an exaggeration. It's difficult for us to imagine philosophy having that kind of impact on teenagers, but there's no reason to doubt Plutarch's sincerity. Not everyone, however, was impressed. Cato the Elder, for one, was incensed. He feared that Roman youth, through contact with philosophy, should, in Plutarch's words, come to prefer a reputation for speaking well before one for deeds and military action. He could not, however, reverse the tide. And by the final decades of the 2nd century BC, elite Romans had begun travelling to Athens and Rhodes and elsewhere to study philosophy. Likewise, philosophers took up temporary residence in Rome. One such was the Stoic Panaetius of Rhodes, who moved to Rome in the 140s. Like the historian Polybius, he became closely associated with the great Philhellene Scipio Aemilianus, and even accompanied him on his journeys. This was in the years immediately following the destruction of Corinth and Carthage by the Romans. Elizabeth Rawson has suggested, perhaps somewhat mischievously, that Panaetius and other philosophers may have thought that the Romans needed a lesson in how to conduct themselves like a civilized people. It was in the early 1st century BC that the teaching of philosophy really began making headway in Rome itself. And this was not due to any concerted plan on the part of the philosophers, but largely the result of circumstance. In 88 BC, for instance, just at the time of the outbreak of the First Mithridatic War, Philo of Larissa, the head of the Academy, fled to Rome as a refugee. As it turned out, both Plato's Academy and Aristotle's Lyceum were destroyed in the sack of Athens by the Roman general Sulla. Philo remained in Rome till his death 5 years later. His greatest pupil was Cicero. Another important philosopher who visited Rome was a Stoic philosopher called Posidonius, who came as an ambassador from Rhodes in 87 BC. The fact that a philosopher was chosen to head a high-level delegation tells us much about the standing of this profession in antiquity and of its influence. Cicero attended Posidonius's school on Rhodes, as did Pompey the Great. Rome was not, however, the only philosophical hub in Italy. Equally important, if not more so, was the Bay of Naples. One of the most prominent philosophers resident in the region was the Epicurean Philodemus of Gadara, Gadara, a town in Syria, who came to Rome in 75 BC. He later attracted a circle of followers in both Herculaneum and Neapolis, among whom were Virgil and Horace. Philodemus eventually won the patronage of a distinguished aristocrat called Lucius Calpurnius Piso Caesonius, consul in 58 BC and father-in-law to Julius Caesar. He was particularly important as a popularizer of Greek philosophy, a task which he undertook primarily for his patron. Philodemus's prose works are preserved on rolls of charred papyri, which were discovered among the ruins of a library attached to a lavish villa at Herculaneum. On the evidence of this discovery, scholars have suggested that the villa belonged to Piso. The existence of the papyri has long been known, but they are only now finally being transcribed and published by the Philodemus Project, which is funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and other institutions. The two main philosophical schools that appealed to the Romans were the Epicurean and the Stoic. Epicurean philosophy was uncompromisingly materialist. Everything it taught is made out of matter. Even the soul is made out of matter, very fine matter, but matter nonetheless. The gods exist, but they aren't interested in human beings, so essentially you might as well forget about them. And when you die, your body and your soul dissolve back into atoms out of which they will reform themselves anew. Our knowledge of Epicureanism doesn't primarily derive from Epicurus, whose work only survives in fragments. And that was not how the Romans got to know his work either. Their knowledge and ours derives primarily from Titus Lucretius Caro, approximate dates 98 to 55 BC, the Roman poet who made it his mission to render Epicurus' doctrine into Latin hexameters. We don't know anything about Lucretius, though there was a rumour reported by the Christian writer Jerome in the 4th century AD that he drank a love potion, went mad and committed suicide. Though we should bear in mind that the Christians were not objective, since Epicureans taught that the soul is mortal and that the cosmos came about as a result of an accident. The poem is composed in hexameter verse, as I mentioned, and loftily entitled On the Nature of Things, De Rerum Natura. It might equally be entitled The Meaning of Life. In our language, Epicurean has come to describe someone who is devoted to the pursuit of sophisticated pleasure. And that is how the enemies of this school portrayed its adherents. But that was not the kind of lifestyle which Epicurus promoted. He taught that humans should not pursue wealth or power or glory, but be content with very little. The goal of life is ataraxia, absence of disturbance, perhaps peace of mind. Lucretius's poem is not only about how to live, it's also about what the world is made of, namely atoms. Our word atom comes from the Greek atomon, meaning indivisible. Epicurus wasn't the first philosopher to come up with an atomic theory. Leucippus and Democritus had already advanced one in the middle of the 5th century BC. But it was he who linked atomic theory to moral philosophy, and that was a very great achievement. Lucretius sums up the goal of Epicureanism with the following question. Do you not see that nature wants nothing else than a body free from pain and a mind released from care, capable of enjoying pleasurable sensations? What's vital is that the enjoyment of pleasure is linked here to a particular kind of mental attitude. As Lucretius goes on to say, it's the simple things of life, like reclining in company on a grassy bank beside a stream, rather than overindulgence or excessive wealth, which brings real pleasure. Very important, too, is the emphasis upon ridding humans both of the fear of death and of the fear of the gods. At the beginning of his poem, he writes, "When human existence lay sprawled upon the ground, like a piece of dirt, oppressed by the weight of religion, threatening mortals from on high with frightening aspect, a Greek was the first who dared raise his eyes against her, the first to take a stand against her." Throughout his poem, Lucretius pays extravagant compliments to Epicurus. Epicurus is his hero. He's the true savior of mankind because he's banished fear from the human race. Nowhere in Latin literature do we find such a ringing endorsement of the contribution of any Greek to humanity at large. There's an interesting aside to all this. Lucretius dedicated his poem to Gaius Memmius, apparently with the intention of converting him to Epicureanism. Memmius was something of a rake. He had affairs with married women, but he purchased a dilapidated house in Athens that had once belonged to Epicurus, possibly attached to the garden I mentioned earlier. He was going to pull it down and put up a new one in its place when the Epicureans caught wind of this and tried to buy it back, evidently to preserve it as a monument to their great founder. They even pleaded with Cicero to intervene, which he duly did. He was a friend of Memmius. We don't know the outcome, but the story is a fascinating one because it shows that Cicero, who was not particularly sympathetic to Epicurean philosophy, he thought that it put virtue on a lower plane than pleasure, took the side of the Epicureans. It was largely thanks to Cicero that those Romans who didn't make it to Athens or Rhodes acquired at least a smattering of Greek philosophy. We've already seen that he himself spent 2 years in Greece and the Greek East in an intensive course of study. He wrote numerous philosophical treatises and translated others from the Greek. In On the Chief Good and Evil, he responds to the objection that it is preferable to read Greek philosophy in Greek rather than his work in Latin, claiming that he adds his own thoughts and doesn't merely summarize. Overall, however, Cicero didn't make an original contribution to philosophy, though he did present it in a style that made it palatable to his Roman readers. Like Lucretius, therefore, his great achievement was as an advocate of Greek philosophy, a very Roman accomplishment. Already by the time that Lucretius was writing his poem, Stoicism had won a far larger following among the Roman elite. It taught that the highest aim of life, the summum bonum I mentioned earlier, was virtue, and that to be virtuous was to be happy. Stoicism permeates Virgil's Aeneid, whose hero demonstrates true stoical fortitude in the face of adversity and loss. There were four great Stoic writers in the Roman imperial period. Seneca the Younger, who was Nero's tutor, Gaius Musonius Rufus, a teacher, Epictetus, a former Phrygian slave, and Marcus Aurelius, an emperor. So quite a broad social spectrum. Of all ancient philosophers, Seneca the Younger comes closest to offering the kind of inspirational advice that is today available in the self-help section of a modern bookshop. In fact, I have just such a book on tape entitled The Spiritual Teachings of Seneca. And indeed, many of his teachings are remarkably close to contemporary purveyors of self-help instruction, such as Deepak Chopra and Thich Nhat Hanh. The tape draws from his work called Moral Essays. Seneca promotes the virtue of humanitas, humanity, and that makes him very attractive to modern readers. All this is rather surprising in view of the fact that he was also the author of the blood-curdling tragedies that we talked about in a previous lecture. And he's also the one philosopher who acknowledged that slaves were human beings and should be treated accordingly, though he didn't suggest that slavery should be abolished. It's sometimes alleged that Stoicism took the lead in teaching people that no man is a slave by nature, but only by accident of war. The fact, however, is that extant Stoic writings are not altogether clear on this subject. And since Stoicism was deterministic, by which I mean that providence or fate plans the main events of one's life in advance, it actually encouraged acceptance of one's lot in life, and thus acceptance of one's status as a slave. Eventually, in 65 BC, Nero charged Seneca with conspiracy, and he was forced to commit suicide. Seneca was the last Roman to write philosophy in Latin. Henceforth, Greek once again became the language of philosophical inquiry. Musonius, AD 25 to 100, although he was a Roman, wrote in Greek. Musonius is memorable because he recommended that women should receive the same education as boys and that they should go on to study philosophy. A generation later, Epictetus, 55 to 135, became the author of the Enchiridion, a Greek word meaning manual. The Enchiridion has been aptly described as the guidebook to the morality of its period. Epictetus held the belief that the mind is always free, even if the body is imprisoned, since everyone is master of his or her thoughts, whatever the circumstances. He wrote, "In our power is our doing. Not in our power are our body, our possessions, our reputation, and our office." It follows that the true Stoic is unaffected by both pain and pleasure, as well as by desire and regret. His aim, one might say, is apatheia, or absence of passion. The last great Stoic was the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, 121 to 180, author of the Meditations, which he wrote in Greek. The Greek title is Ta Eis Hearton, simply means to himself. There are also elements of Platonism and Epicureanism in his work, and it's possible that he didn't embrace the Stoic doctrine until relatively late in his life. He repeatedly stresses themes like the brevity of human life, the need to be tolerant to one's fellows, the importance of hard work, but there's also a pervasive tone of resignation, even pessimism, running through his writing. Soon after his death, a philosophical school called Neoplatonism was founded. This was a revival of Platonism, though it also incorporated elements from Pythagoras, a founder of a philosophical school that advocated a form of separatism from the life of the Greek city, as well as elements from Aristotle and from the Stoics. As a syncretic combination, therefore, it thus exemplifies a characteristically Roman approach to philosophy. Its leading exponents included Plotinus, 205 to 70, Porphyry, 232 to 305, and Proclus, 412 to 485. The greatest was Plotinus, a fascinating example of the cultural diversity that came about in late antiquity. He was born in Egypt, we don't know where. His name is Roman, and his native language, and the language too that he wrote in, was Greek. His pupil Porphyry collected all his writings and divided them into six books known as the Aeneids, which means groups of nine. Aenea is the Greek word for nine. Plotinus particularly favoured the method of presenting a difficulty or aporia, which he would then work through quite informally as if giving a seminar. Neoplatonism sought to demonstrate how the soul could reach God. It had a profound effect upon pagans, including Julian, the last pagan emperor, as well as upon Christian thinkers such as Augustine. We tend to think of philosophers today as rather irrelevant. Not so in antiquity. First, they provided an essential service. Whether you were a physician, politician, or lawyer, training in philosophy was essential. As J.M. Dillon writes, "In the absence of an agreed religious orthodoxy, a general knowledge of the main issues of philosophy was part of the intellectual baggage of every educated man." Second, philosophers were prominent in public life. They not only attached themselves to kings and emperors, they were also in demand as diplomats and ambassadors. Third, philosophers often took a stance that was critical of the establishment, and when they did so, they were listened to. Socrates, for instance, was executed by the Athenian Demos in 399 BC on the charges of corrupting the young and others. Whatever the substance behind them, they would not have brought charges if Socrates had been harmless and irrelevant, so their testimony to his high profile. And nor, to skip down to the Roman period, would the Senate have expelled philosophers were it not for the fact that they were making a considerable impact on Roman youth. Again, in the reign of Nero and the Flavians, it was philosophers, Stoics in particular, who were most critical of the emperors. It's a measure of the strength and importance of Epicureanism that the Senate had decreed, perhaps in the reign of Vespasian, that the head of the school in Athens had to be a Roman citizen. And finally, Justinian's legislation forbidding pagans to teach philosophy in Athens effectively shut down the school, since it was pagans almost exclusively who were qualified in the discipline. It was a measure aimed at the heart of paganism, and as such, again, is testimony to the continuing importance of philosophy in late antiquity as an instrument of challenge to the authority of the state. Despite the best efforts of the Byzantines, however, Greek philosophy is still with us today. No one put it better than Bernard Williams. The legacy of the Greeks to Western philosophy was Western philosophy. I would add to that that it was the legacy of the Romans to bestow upon the discipline a central role in the education of the elite, with the result that it exercised a shaping hand in the mindset of its governing class. In the next lecture, we will turn our attention from philosophy to the fascination in which Greek culture was held at the highest levels of Roman society, a fascination that amounted to nothing less than an obsession.